research.
When you hear a genuine expert say something like that, you start to see how we've all been gamed when it comes to understanding nuclear dangers. And you start to realize that you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we revisit an interview with Joseph Mangano, Executive Director of Radiation and Public Health. Joe is an expert researcher and epidemiologist whose examination of medical statistics in the areas around nuclear reactors reveal a much different picture of the health impact from radiation than the nuclear industry wants you to know. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than is carried by all three major U.S. broadcast networks in any given week, or Fox pseudo-news ever. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The United States Supreme Court has upheld the state of Virginia's ban on uranium mining in a declaration released on Monday morning, June 17, 2019. Since 1982, Virginia has had a moratorium on uranium mining due to public health concerns with the potential effect of uranium mining on employees and surrounding community. The lead petitioner in the case, Virginia Uranium Incorporated, argued the state doesn't have the authority to enforce the ban, stating that the Virginia ban was preempted by the Federal Atomic Energy Act, which gives the federal government the regulation over nuclear power generation. And uranium, of course, is an element used in atomic bombs. But the High Court ruled the state law barring uranium mining was not trumped, that's the word they used, trumped by the Federal Atomic Energy Act. A wide range of groups, including the Southern Environmental Law Center, Roanoke River Basin Association, and the Danville-Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce, had most recently cited their support for the moratorium in Friends of the Court briefs submitted to the Supreme Court. This decision has major implications about the rights of the states to regulate uranium mining, and Nuclear Hot Seat will be following up to see how that plays out across the country. In far less pleasing terms, for more than 30 years, the Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board has been entrusted with monitoring some of the most radioactive locations in the United States. That work is now being trimmed back by the Trump administration, which has limited the board's access to the Hanford site in Washington State and other federal nuclear cleanup sites. This could potentially lead to engineering and safety problems being ignored because those troubles could be inconvenient for a federal government stuck in a decades-long and very expensive slog to clean up Hanford and other sites throughout the U.S. At Hanford in southeast Washington State, the Defense Board and its on-site inspectors have had significant roles in making sure a huge and troubled radioactive waste vitrification plant is meeting technical and safety standards. At stake is the prevention of future safety disasters and crippling equipment breakdowns in highly radioactive areas that can hamper cleanup at Hanford. This change in Defense Board access accompanies other recent efforts by the Trump administration to adjust its approach to the cleanup of harmful wastes. In one case, the administration, through paperwork, is seeking to reclassify some highly radioactive waste at Hanford with a less dangerous designation, a move that would cut costs and shorten timetables, but do nothing to mitigate the dangers. Also, the Trump administration has attempted to lower cleanup appropriations for Hanford and other Department of Energy sites, including the Idaho National Laboratory and Savannah River site, though Congress has had some success in fighting the proposed cutbacks. The whole mega issue of nuclear waste, highly radioactive nuclear waste, and what to do with it has been exploding, you should pardon the term, in media. From Omaha, Nebraska, comes word that the decommissioning of the Fort Calhoun nuclear plant is going to be speeded up to save time and money, though the storage containers will remain on the site indefinitely. Note that when it comes to decommissioning a nuclear reactor, saving time and saving money are not necessarily the first priorities when long-term safety should be the focus. The Oyster Creek shutdown in New Jersey is warning that it could leave high tasks along with giant casks of dangerous radioactive fuel. Paul Berkowitz, a local resident who lives within 3 miles of Oyster Creek, put it succinctly when he said, "Nobody would agree to have a power plant anywhere, in any community, if they were going to have the next generations live with the waste. But indeed, that is the case." Holtec International has received approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to purchase and decommission Oyster Creek and has also applied to decommission Indian Point in Buchanan, New York, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and Palisades Power Plant in Covert, Michigan. As the nuclear industry shrinks, the so-called spent radioactive fuel, which is highly radioactive and far from spent, totals more than 80,000 metric tons, or have this picture in your mind, enough to fill a football field 20 meters or 65 feet deep. Now that Three Mile Island in Middletown, Pennsylvania, is definitely closing at the end of September 2019, they're revealing that it could take nearly 60 years and $1.2 billion to decommission the facility, with the nuclear waste sitting in storage between the two units' cooling towers for the foreseeable future. Note that companies such as Holtec International and Westinghouse Electric Company are interested in buying up closing plants, including Three Mile Island, so they can disassemble them promptly, meaning rush and take shortcuts that are not necessarily in the interest of long-term safety. But by doing so, they can keep what is left in the decommissioning trust fund when the process is complete. So fast equals more money, and to hell with the people who live in the areas. But hey, they say they can do the job of decommissioning in not the 60 years that are predicted, but in some cases as little as 8 years. I can't even imagine the dangerous situation that would be left behind. And when it comes to what people in the local community can face as a result of having had a nuclear reactor and having it shut down, consider Maine Yankee, which is off the coast of Wiscasset, Maine. Maine Yankee stopped producing power in 1996. That's 23 years ago. But yet, the owners of the shuttered nuclear power plant pay armed guards to watch 60 cement and steel canisters loaded with decades worth of spent nuclear fuel, each weighing 150 tons. The cost? $10 million a year. And that is a cost that would not be covered by leftover decommissioning funds. It would be just sucked up by Holtec, Westinghouse, or any other company that says they can do it lickety-split. Holtec has been pushing hard for the creation of a so-called interim waste storage facility in New Mexico, and the state of New Mexico is having none of it. U.S. Congresswoman Deb Haaland of New Mexico cited her opposition to storing high-level nuclear waste in New Mexico in a letter to the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In her letter, she cited operational and logistical risks that pose a risk to the state and said, "The concept of an interim storage facility is inherently flawed because it will result in waste being moved twice, first to the interim facility and then to a permanent repository. This increases the chances that the waste will be involved in an incident during transportation." And indeed, as if to prove her point, On Wednesday, June 19, a train carrying military munitions and hazardous materials derailed near a northeastern Nevada town. While it is being put out that, luckily it turned out that nothing hazardous was released into the air or the ground, after the 23 cars derailed, first responders were being released from the wreck site and were decontaminated for good measure. So nothing hazardous happened, but we're decontaminating just in case. In a case of he said, the New York Times published an article suggesting that Nebraska's Cooper Nuclear Station has seen its communications networks hacked by the Russians. The story went on to say that Nebraska Public Power District was informed by federal officials in 2017 about a hacking campaign that targeted U.S. nuclear plants, to which NPPD spokesman Mark Becker said, "Nobody got into our system," with no further information to back that up. On Thursday morning, June 20th, residents throughout the Southeast were startled by an alert of a radiological hazard warning in Georgia. The Georgia Emergency Management Agency said the alerts, which came through on phones, radios, and televisions around 7 a.m., were part of a test. But the alerts did not say, "This is only a test." Residents in Alabama, Florida, and South Carolina all reported receiving this alert. Epidemiology has not yet been done to determine the number of heart incidents at local hospitals as a result. And now,
nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
This week's numbnuts focuses on Victoria, the great-granddaughter of Katie the Goat. And to understand what Victoria's story is all about, you need to understand about Katie. And yes, calling her a goat is literal, not pejorative. She was living on a farm 5 miles northeast of the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant in Waterford, Connecticut, when her milk was donated to Dominion Energy, the operators of Millstone, for its environmental radiological sampling program. The milk was shown to contain exceptionally high concentrations of strontium-90, a carcinogen produced only in nuclear fission. With a concentration of 55 picocuries per liter in 2001, Katie's milk contained the highest level of strontium-90 ever detected in the state of Connecticut, perhaps the nation. It was twice the highest concentration recorded in milk sampled in Connecticut during the peak of atmospheric nuclear weapons testing in the 1960s. There were elevated levels of strontium-90, as well as strontium-89 and cesium-137. Katie was adopted by Mothball Millstone, and from 2006 until her death from inoperable cancer in 2012, she served as a standard bearer and an example of what can go wrong when one is exposed to radionuclides. Politicians refused to meet with her and representatives of the group. They refused to test her milk. They wanted to have nothing to do with her. When Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection finally investigated this milk, they released a report absolving Dominion of any blame for radioactive strontium in Katie's milk, but did not offer an alternative explanation as to where that dang stuff may have come from. By the way, the Department of Environmental Protection commissioner who took responsibility for the report that exonerated Dominion was Gina McCarthy, who would later become head of the U.S. EPA's Air and Radiation Bureau, most specifically during the Fukushima emergency, when all the West Coast monitoring stations were turned off. But I digress. Katie was a mascot and a rallying point until her death in 2012, which was mourned internationally, including on this program. Now, Mothball Millstone has asked the State of Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, or DEEP, to test the milk sample from Victoria the Goat on May 27 for the presence of radioactivity. Victoria lives and munches grass 25 miles downwind of the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant, and DEEP is required by state law to monitor the environment downwind of nuclear power plants for the buildup of radioactivity. But it has no such monitoring program. The state's director of radiation, Jeffrey Simanchik, has refused to test Victoria's milk. He says nuclear reactor licensees are not required by the federal government to test goat milk more than 10 miles from a nuclear power plant, a point which is highly debatable. Here's the problem. DEEP is not a nuclear power plant licensee. Its allegiance is supposed to be to the public interest, not the nuclear industry. And note that Symantec's prior employer was Dominion Energy. He was a Millstone 3 operator. And he's still a nuclear operator, though of a different sort. Here's the numbnuts part. Symantec has forbidden Mothball Millstone from sending any more of Victoria's goat milk samples for DEEP lab analysis, saying that if they did, the samples would not be analyzed, but would be isolated as, quote, potentially hazardous materials. What? So according to Symantec, everything is completely all right, even though it is potentially hazardous. Give it a rest. And that's why this week, on behalf of Victoria and her great-grandmother, Katie the Goat, Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, or DEEP, and Jeffrey Symantec, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Over to Japan, where the route for the torchbearers for the 2020 Tokyo Radioactive Olympics has been announced, and it's more cynical than one could possibly imagine. It's not bad enough that the torch relay starts in Fukushima. The first 3 days of the torch relay are in Fukushima. The first day plots a zigzag path directly around the Fukushima Daiichi triple meltdown site, which is still highly radioactive. As somebody wrote on Facebook, no one would conduct such a relay in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. But this, the IOC, the Japanese government, and the UN hierarchy would endorse turning a blind eye and making this into a farce. The vast majority of sites the first day are within 30 kilometers or 18 and a half miles around Fukushima Daiichi, including Hirono, Naraha, Tomioka, Okuma, Namie, Katsurao, and Minamisoma. The next 2 days are also within 50 miles of Fukushima Daiichi, which you may recall was the evacuation radius suggested for U.S. citizens to get the hell out of Dodge when the accident happened. And the area is still highly contaminated with radioactive materials. Utter insanity. We'll put the map up on the site, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 318. And we are learning that thyroid cancers among children outside of Fukushima Prefecture are already being reported. 9 thyroid cancer cases, not nodules, full cancers, were already found among children in Tokyo. 7 cases each in Saitama and Kanagawa prefectures, and 6 cases in Miyagi Prefecture. This according to data from 311 Fund for Children with Thyroid Cancer, an NPO that provides financial aid to families of children who were 18 or younger at the time of the nuclear meltdown, the triple nuclear meltdown, in 2011. And Japanese fishermen in Iwaki and Fukushima Prefecture are releasing young flatfish into the sea close to where the highest radioactive pollution has accumulated. Flatfish are bottom feeders. Radionuclides are heavy metals and sink to the bottom of any body of water, and so you do the math. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares, but you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person like yourself a regular weekly dose of nuclear news you can count on to be honest, vetted, footnoted, and accurate. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program anywhere that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. We're now in our 9th year and have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues. Not that it's that hard. They're not even trying. You can count on Nuclear Hot Seat to get behind the scenes, under the skin, and into the heart of nuclear matters every week, with fresh information and an unrelenting perspective. So if having this information helps you understand what's going on in the world, nuclearly speaking, help us keep getting it out to you. The show is financed exclusively by donations from listeners like you, and any amount helps. You can send a one-time donation of any size by going to nuclearhotseat.com and clicking on the big red donate button. And if you're on a budget, as so many of us are these days, there's also a big green donate button that allows you to quickly set up a recurring donation of just $5 a month. Now face it, you would spend that on a cup of coffee and a tip here in the USA. And these small donations every month that we can count on are the lifeblood of the show. So we're in our ninth year. Help us celebrate by buying Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of metaphoric coffee, or several if you can, and know that whatever you can do to help us, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. Joseph Mangano is a health researcher, an epidemiologist who has served as a director of Radiation and Public Health Project since 1989. Mangano is author or co-author of 33 medical journal articles on radiation health and is the author of the books Low-Level Radiation and Immune System Damage, An Atomic Era Legacy, that's a 1998 book, and Radioactive Baby Teeth, The Cancer Link, from 2008. He managed the study of strontium-90 in baby teeth and now manages the citizen-based radiation monitoring programs near the Indian Point, New York, and Oyster Creek, New Jersey, nuclear plants. This interview was originally heard on Nuclear Hot Seat number 354 from April 3, 2018.
Joe Mangano, always great to have you with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Likewise. Glad to be here.
First of all, let's give people an idea of your group. What is Radiation and Public Health Project, and how did it come to be?
We are a non-for-profit research and educational group. The truth is that we shouldn't even have existed in the first place had the nuclear industry and government been honest. When nuclear reactors were first built in the 1950s, there were several questions concerning the health of local residents. Number one, can we guarantee that there isn't going to be a major meltdown? Number two, how much radiation is going to be routinely released to the air? And number three, what are we going to do with the waste? The waste products produced in making electricity, but that has to be kept safe for hundreds of thousands of years. What happened was the industry and government kind of colluded and just said, we're going to set some limits of safe limits, permissible limits, they call them. You know, if you release below a certain amount of radiation, or if the air and the water and the soil has below a certain amount, you're allowed to keep your license, you can keep running the reactor, and we call it safe. Now, we are a public health group. This isn't very good public health, all right? As a matter of fact, the radiation at low levels may be safe. But you got to do the studies. You've got to prove it. You can't just assume it. These are very dangerous chemicals we're talking about, the same that are created and released when atomic bombs explode. So just about 30 years ago, two retired gentlemen, one a physicist and the other a statistician, put together this group, and we have been at it ever since. 37 journal articles, 8 books, 57 or so op-eds, lots of media attention, and so on. That's a bit of background of what we do.
What kind of information do you examine when you are coming up with your reports on what's going on around the nuclear reactor?
Two things. Dose and response are the formal names for them. By dose, we look at how much radiation is released from a reactor, how much exists in the local environment, the air and the water and the food and the body. We did a study measuring how much radiation were in the baby teeth of 5,000 children, most of them living near nuclear reactors. To date, this is the only study ever done looking at how much radiation is in the body of Americans living near reactors. And that's the dose side. The response side, very simply, is disease rates and death rates near nuclear plants, which our public health departments actually do a very fine job of collecting data and making them available on the web, both the state health departments and the Centers for Disease Control. That's what our work really has entailed. We haven't gotten to all reactors, but we've done studies near a number of them. And we find consistently that red flags are raised about unusually high levels of cancer and infant mortality and other disorders, especially after a nuclear plant opens.
Where do you find the numbers that you base your findings on?
The big one is the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. They haven't gone out and done studies near reactors, but they've done a fine job in collecting data. In fact, there are 50 years worth of statistics on mortality, on deaths in the United States, beginning in 1968. Right online, it has it by state, by county, by cause of death, by age, by gender, by race. It makes it rather easy for us to do a lot of analysis down to the county level. That's the major source that we use. And for the other side, the radiation side, how much is released and how much is in the environment, those come from the Environmental Protection Agency. Companies that run nuclear reactors are required to make these measurements every year and to report them.
What you've been working on is called epidemiology, and you're actually the reason that I have any familiarity at all with the term. It's the study and analysis of the distribution and determinants of health and disease conditions in defined populations. In other words, trying to work out why certain people in certain locations are getting ill. So let's take a look at some of the reactors that you have been studying. Let's start with Oyster Creek in New Jersey, which is scheduled to be closing in October of this year, 2018. How did that formerly low-cancer county rise to become a high-cancer county after the reactor started up?
Yeah, Libby, I hope we haven't scared anyone with a big word like epidemiology. Let's make it simple. These are basic questions like, what are cancer rates like near nuclear reactors like Oyster Creek? Very simple. Again, if it weren't for us and our group and our work, the answer would be, geez, we really don't know. Nobody does studies on this. Oyster Creek is a case in point. It is a reactor that is in central New Jersey. It's about 60 miles from New York City, and it's about 50 miles from Philadelphia. Obviously, lots and lots of people nearby. Strike two on Oyster Creek, it is the longest-running nuclear reactor in the United States, and I believe the world. The day it first started operating and generating radiation and emitting radiation was May 3rd, 1969. So we're coming in on 49 years here. Yes, even though reactors were supposed to go to 40 years at maximum. Point three with Oyster Creek is that even though the statistics on what was emitted from reactors are a little thin, unfortunately, the requirements are not very stiff. Because there are over 100 separate radioactive chemicals produced by reactors and emitted into the environment, a good system would be to make counts of each of them. There's only several that are counted. But one of them, iodine-131, we'll talk about it later, it's a chemical that affects the thyroid gland. It goes right, you know, when it's drank in the water and eaten in the food or breathed in, these little metal particles go right to the thyroid gland where it attacks and kills cells and leads to diseases like cancer. We found in the 70s and the 80s and the 1990s, Oyster Creek had the highest level of emissions than any U.S. reactor. Matter of fact, it had five times the amount that was officially released from the Three Mile Island partial meltdown, 1979.
And this was just part of its normal operating. It wasn't like they had an accident that happened there that created some radiation leak.
there was no meltdown, there was no shutdown by the government to saying that you're releasing too much, none of that. These were all part of normal operations.
How did that impact the cancer rates in the area?
Well, we took a look. We've actually been working on Oyster Creek for quite a while because our group is based in New York, and this is very close to New York City. We did a whole educational campaign, you know, in conjunction with local citizen groups. We even had a couple of celebrity supporters, Alec Baldwin and Christy Brinkley, and we went to that area of central New Jersey and gave a number of public talks. We collected 600 baby teeth from the area and found a high and rising amount of another chemical, strontium 90, which goes into teeth and to bone. As far as the cancer goes, there's been suspicions for a long time near Oyster Creek. Back in the 1990s, the health department, the state health department, found a childhood cancer cluster. And a very long story short, after about 10 years of meetings and discussion, no official cause of cancer was ever admitted to by the health department. In fact, they gave Oyster Creek, the nuclear component, very little attention at all. Years ago, when Oyster Creek first began operating, the cancer death rate in the county where it's located, Ocean County, was just below the New Jersey rate, 1% below. As the 1980s and 90s went along, it grew a couple of percent above the state rate, and in the 2000s, it was 8% higher. Now, going from 1% below to 8% above may not sound like very much, but let's turn it into real numbers and real people. If that original rate of 1% below the state had stayed, you know, all these past 49 years, there would have been over 2,500 fewer cancer deaths in this one county. Okay,
that's jaw-dropping.
That 2,500 is a lot of people. It's a very populated county. It's about 600,000 in the county. We also found, too, that the largest increases occurred in the youngest residents in the area. We know, you know, scientists agree, that while every human who is exposed to radiation is affected, the greatest harm is caused to the very youngest. That is the fetus, the infant, and the child. And we found that the childhood cancer rate years ago was 23% below New Jersey, and now it's risen to 15% above. Again, we're converting a low cancer county into a high cancer county. Are there other possible reasons? Sure, there might be, but we don't know of any. That would make this before and after switch like this, and we feel that there should have been more studies done. The health departments and the industry that ran the plant basically either ignored us or called our work. You know, they'll use terms like junk science. Do they have any proof that Oyster Creek is safe? Nope, not one.
Given that this situation was found around Oyster Creek, are there other reactors where similar patterns have been found and where populations are suffering from similar consequences?
Oh, sure. I could give you several, but the one I'll focus on is the other nuclear plant in New Jersey, and that's called Salem Hope Creek. It's a little different than Oyster Creek. Oyster Creek has one reactor. Salem Hope Creek has three. Oyster Creek is relatively small. Salem not only has three reactors, but each is about double the capacity of Oyster Creek. This is a big place. The reactors came online later than Oyster Creek, from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. Okay, so we did a similar study of Salem County, where this reactor is located. A little bit different. Oyster Creek is 600,000 people. Salem only has about 65,000 people. It's largely rural. Farming is the primary industry, if you will, which should mean that there's no real worry about industrial pollution in the area. So let's go back. As the reactors were opening in the mid-1980s, the Salem County cancer death rate, just like Oyster Creek, was 5% below the rest of New Jersey. Now, in this decade, that 5% below the state has turned into 20% above the state.
That's a 25% change.
A 25% flip. And it, once again, it is highest in children, in young adults, and in middle-aged adults, like we would have expected if nuclear emissions were a factor. We even found that there was a jump in death rates for causes other than cancer, all right, from 2% higher to 23% higher. And once again, we'll go to the what we call the excess cancer cases. Since the mid-80s, we estimate that over 1,000 people died because these rates went up. All right, if they had stayed where they were back in the mid-80s and continued for the last 30 years, over 1,000 fewer people would have died in this one small county.
So we're getting a pretty clear picture that nuclear reactors under normal operating conditions create problems and have emissions and, according to the epidemiology, impact cancer rates and leads to an increase in them. But let's look now at what happens when there has been what the nuclear industry once upon a time assured us would never happen, which is an accident, meaning Three Mile Island. And the nuclear industry is fond of saying nobody died at Three Mile Island. Now there is a Facebook-based group, Three Mile Island Survivors, that has over 4,000 members who identify with that label. And these individuals claim a wide range of health impacts from that nuclear partial meltdown in 1979. And there are reports of a large number of deaths and illnesses within their own families and communities. What does the epidemiology tell us about what really happened as a result of the accident at Three Mile Island?
I'll start my answer by repeating what I said a few minutes ago, and that is the nuclear industry grabbed that slogan, nobody died at Three Mile Island, almost immediately after the meltdown occurred. Before there had been any chance to measure how much radiation was released, how much actually got into the water and the food and people's bodies, and so on. It was an immediate attempt to stifle any type of research. Even though I consider myself a health researcher and a non-political one, we all understand that this is a very, very highly politicized area. And the example I'll give before we get into our results involves two groups. The first group was some researchers from Columbia University in New York. They got some funding from a group that was commissioned by a judge after the Three Mile accident. Their mission was to go and do some research on whether or not there was a connection between the radiation released from Three Mile and cancer in the local area. Very simply, their answer was no, there was no association. And they published an article in the American Journal of Public Health. I mean, these are, again, Columbia is a highly reputed university, and these are all, you know, PhDs and physicians and so on. And they gave, in the articles, they gave the data that they used. Well, along comes a group from the University of North Carolina School of Public Health, which I happen to be a graduate of, headed by a gentleman, Dr. Stephen Wing, working with a group of his colleagues. Wing and the UNC people took the same data that the Columbia people used and came to a different conclusion. They only looked at lung cancer and leukemia within the 10-mile radius around Three Mile Island, and they found a high increase. As a matter of fact, it's amazing to me that Columbia came to that conclusion of no link, because if you look at the number of cancers of people living within 10 miles of Three Mile Island, and you compared 5 years before and after the meltdown, the number of cancers went up 60%, from 1,700-something to 2,800-something. Now, you don't need a PhD in epidemiology. You don't need an MD from Columbia or UNC to say, whoa, wait a minute, is this normally what happens in an area where our cancer's going up 60%? The answer, of course, is no. And What happened after that was essentially a fight that broke out in the medical journals. The Columbia people were agitated and called the UNC group, you know, politically motivated and all this stuff. And UNC just responded with explaining how they came up with this. Once again, I'm trying not to be political, but this is maybe one of the better examples of how highly politicized this is. The establishment does not want to admit to one death. No one died at Three Mile Island, because that means there's a lot of other people that may be suffering and dying as well.
And that's why this Facebook group got started. I believe it's following in the steps of North St. Louis and the Just Moms there with what yes. they've been able to create by growing the awareness. Let's move this ahead. You told me that you're looking into an analysis of cancer deaths in Burke County, Georgia, which is the site of the Bogle plant where they're trying to build two new reactors and coming into all kinds of problems. But do they have nuclear fuel on site yet? Are there radioactive fuel rods there? Or is there some other cause for the difficulty that people are facing?
This is Burke County, Georgia. Now, it is a county that sits on the border with South Carolina. And the border actually is the Savannah River. We need to give a little history here. Right across the river from Burke County, Georgia, lies the Savannah River plant. The Savannah River plant was built way, way back in 1949. It formerly was a mostly farming, rural area. This was not a nuclear power reactor, but it was a series of reactors that helped make nuclear weapons. At that time, of course, it was the Cold War, and the U.S. and the Soviet Union were engaged in a frantic race to build as many nuclear weapons as possible. And the Savannah River played a major, major role in making these bombs. Of course, now it is no longer making weapons. We've stopped that when the Cold War ended in the early 90s. It's a large area, and it is highly contaminated, one of the most contaminated areas in the United States. And it's been cleaned up now for 20 years, and they're going to be at it for a very long time. So let's start there. Right across the river is Burke County, Georgia. A nuclear reactor has to be on a body of water because, essentially, the way a nuclear reactor makes electricity is to heat water up. Somebody called it a very dangerous and expensive way to boil water. The Savannah River is a large, wide river at that point. It flows into the Atlantic Ocean. In the late 1980s, two nuclear power plants, power reactors, were built in Burke County, and they were called Vogtle 1 and Vogtle 2. They wanted a Vogtle 3 and 4, but like many proposed reactors, they were canceled, essentially because they were expensive. But, of course, I always say that, why are the reactors expensive? It takes a lot of money to build such dangerous machines. Burke County, again, is like across in South Carolina. It's a rural county. It's got about 23,000 people. Slightly over half are African American. The poverty rate is very high in Burke County, always has been. Okay, the unemployment rate is high. The proportion of inadequate housing is high. All the standard measures of poverty occur in Burke County. It's a poor county, all right? The idea of building these reactors in a formerly pristine area, of course, raises the question, did it do anything to the health of local residents? Well, once again, you go back to the CDC website and look at what happened. In the 1970s, before the reactors opened, the black cancer mortality rate was 29% below the rest of Georgia. And that makes sense because we don't expect a lot of cancer in rural areas. We expect cancer, you know, in areas where there are coal mines or in big cities with a lot of industrial emissions and so on. That number of 29% below now in the last decade is 15% above. And these are for blacks. Whites had an increase, too, in Burke County. Years ago, they were 1% below and now 12% above. Again, the poverty rates are considerably higher for blacks in Burke County than they are for whites.
So what you're saying is that the radiation that is impacting the health of the people in Burke County actually comes from the other side of the river and this previous facility.
Well, previously, some of it did. More of it in the Savannah River plant in South Carolina. More of it stayed in South Carolina, although some got to Georgia. Still, the cancer rate was below average. All right, it wasn't until they built those two nuclear reactors in Burke County, in Georgia, right there, when the cancer rates began to change from below average to well above average.
And for the sake of clarity, we know that there are two new reactors that are under construction, but are there other reactors that are on the site of Vogtle that are in operation and have been?
The answer to both your questions are yes and yes. The ones that began operating in the late 80s continue to operate, even though they're getting older and corroding and leaking and so on. But in the, about 10, 15 years ago, there was an effort to build new reactors. Building had stopped, essentially. The last approvals for reactors were in the late 70s because the people that financed it, you know, the Wall Street people, understood it to be very expensive and very dangerous. So this nuclear renaissance, as they called it, began, and there was a lot of discussion in Washington, and they did after years and years was, I think the number was $15 billion. Not to help build reactors, but in case a new reactor was built and they had to stop, that the builders would get their money back. There was a number of reactors that were proposed, like 20 of them. Almost every one pulled out. They said, you know what? We can't do this. This is going to take years and years to build these things. It's going to take a heck of a lot of money. We've got new types and safer types of energy like solar and wind. Forget it. An exception was the Vogtle plant, where reactors 3 and 4 were not completely built, but the building process began, I believe it was about 8 years ago. And there have been all these promises about when they're going to be finished and how much it would cost. Well, guess what? As the years go on, the expected year of opening keeps getting pushed further in the future, and of course the bill gets bigger and bigger. Right now, the construction is only about one-third done, and this is after about eight or ten years. That's very slow. That means it's going to take 20, 25 years or more to finish these things and an ungodly amount of money. There is a very strong citizen-based effort to stop the construction, and there's a lot of people who believe that these two reactors will never operate. And of course, part of it is the idea of environmental injustice or racial injustice in this case, that you're picking on a very poor area with a large proportion of African Americans and putting these dangerous reactors, more of these dangerous reactors there.
That was health researcher Joseph Mangano of Radiation and Public Health Project. You can read more about his important work at radiation.org. And active shout out. Kudos and hats off to 22 peace activists aged 30 to 87 who were arrested for blocking traffic or gates outside Bath Iron Works in Maine on the morning of June 22nd, immediately before the christening of the new guided missile destroyer, the USS Daniel Inouye. The General Dynamics Bath Ironworks site has often been the target of demonstrations and protest by Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and its co-founder, Bruce Gagnon, a Nuclear Hot Seat regular interviewee. The group's work can be followed at nukesforpeace.org, and that's the number 4, not spelling out 4. General Dynamics is one of the 28 companies targeted for financial divestment by the Netherlands-based Don't Bank on the Bomb program. This is for its role in building components of nuclear bombs. So hats off to the activists for standing up or sitting in for what they believe. And we received a letter from Susan R. Gordon, who is coordinator for the Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment. This is a network of five grassroots groups working to oppose new uranium mining and advocates for cleanup of the radioactive and toxic legacy left behind in the Navajo Nation communities. She writes, on July 16, 1979, an earthen dam owned by the United Nuclear Corporation broke and released 1,100 million tons of radioactive uranium tailings and 94 million gallons of toxic wastewater into the Rio Puerco, contaminating the river for at least 80 miles. The spill remains the single largest release of radioactive material in U.S. history. Yet its effects on the health of the area's people and animals and harm to the environment has not been adequately studied by the government. Every July 16, for the past 40 years, as Edith Hood, a leader of the Redwater Pond Road Community Association on Navajo Nation, explains, we walk to the site and say healing prayers. We believe we need to support one another and cherish all our families and communities, just as our elders have. By working together with our combined intelligence and wisdom, we can address the legacy to provide a life of balance and harmony for our people and future generations. What can any of us do? We are being asked to consider sending a letter of support to the Redwater Pond Road community, recognizing their 40-year struggle to gain environmental justice through cleanup and health studies done in their community. If you are willing to send a statement, please address it to the Redwater Pond Road Community Association and send it in care of Susan R. Gordon. Her email address is swuraniumimpacts.org. The request is for letters of support to be received no later than July 11 so that they can be included in the ceremonies. I'll, of course, have a link and further information up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 418. A little side note here. As is so often the case, any of the nuclear atrocities that take place on lands of poor people, Native people, people of color, are ignored. And even within our own community, there are many people who do not know anything about the Church Rock uranium spill. I know I didn't until about 3.5 years into doing this show when I first heard about it from Leona Morgan of the Diné people. Navajo Nation sent a letter of support to the people of Three Mile Island on their 40th anniversary. While they are specifically asking for support from the Three Mile Island community, any nuclear group around the world deserves to take their request for support very seriously. And I know it would mean the world to them to know that the world is listening and knows about what they have been suffering. So again, there will be further information on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under episode 418. And I urge you, both groups and individuals, to make a statement and let them know that they are not alone in this struggle and are part of the world that is fighting back against all the nuclear ignorance, arrogance, and devastation. And know that I will be there for the commemoration and report everything back to you here on Nuclear Hot Seat. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 25th, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, lohud.com, omaha.com, app.cm, kitv.com, godownriver.com, crosscut.com, rgi.com, currentargus.com, CNN, exchangemonitor.com, CapitolHillSeattle.com, AL.com, National Nuclear Workers for Justice, MothballMillstone.com, Nippon.com, Newsweek, NHK.OR.JP, SundayGuardianLive.com, Bloomberg.com, and the misguided, short-sighted dolts at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who don't understand what's wrong with burying 72 Chernobyls worth of high-level radioactive waste in 5/8-inch thin canisters only 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean at San Onofre, the same so-called solution they want to try at Pilgrim in New York. A big shout out to all of you who are listening. We are in 123 countries on 6 continents around the world and counting. And Nuclear Hot Seat is also syndicated through Pacifica's AudioPort network. If you know of a radio station or blog or anywhere that would like to link to Nuclear Hot Seat and be able to get the program for free every week, please send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. You can find all of our back episodes at that same website. And if you want to search a little bit easier, you can add /blog to the URL and check back 10 episodes at a time. Haven't said this for a while, but I need to acknowledge my musicians. The theme song was written by me, but arranged and sung by Marilee Weber, with accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. Now, if you don't want to have to mess around and try and figure out where in the world you're going to get Nuclear Hot Seat, you can get it delivered every week to your inbox via email. It's easy to set up. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and look for the big yellow box. Everything's color-coded on the site. Yellow box. And you can sign up there for our weekly email link by just putting in your first name and your email address. I promise I won't sell it. I won't share it. I won't do anything with it except send you Nuclear Hot Seat and maybe notices of actions that are taking place. You can also participate in the show if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview. I get many of my best leads by listeners reaching out to me and saying, hey, do you know about this? Because unless I'm made aware of something, I don't always know. So you can do this by sending an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you've listened this far, you're probably someone who appreciates weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world. So we'd really appreciate it if you'd take just a moment and send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com, because we not only appreciate your support, we need it to keep going. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the last thing anyone who opposes nuclear ever wants to be able to say is, I told you so. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.
UCY.TV.
I
I have seen the torch of freedom pass from hand to yearning hand, and the vision of our fathers spread hope throughout this land.